My name is Jackie Lamport. Today is Wednesday, February 9th. Welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast. Today on the show.
We didn't end the long-term program because we don't think it's needed. We didn't end it because we don't think it's valuable as a healing path, or that we didn't wish we still could offer it.
Survivors of sexual assault in Victoria are finding fewer options to support them, despite a growing need for service. We look into the problem, how it fits into the gap in access to mental health care, and what the province is doing about it. Today's Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by St. Margaret's School. Have you thought about St. Margaret's School as a possibility for your child? The supportive, girl-centered environment of SMS creates boundless possibilities where a personalized, inquiry-based education and experiential programs will help shape the next generation of female leaders. At St. Margaret's, girls don't just get equal opportunity. They get every opportunity from kindergarten to graduation. SMS is committed to as many families as possible having the opportunity to support their child in exceeding her expectations and realizing her own potential. We know paying for tuition is a significant investment for many families, which is why over 500,000 in tuition assistance and scholarships are awarded to SMS students each year. For a chance to soar, apply today at stmarg.ca. That's stmarg.ca. Victoria has a problem when it comes to long-term counseling options. The problem is, they're hard to find, and harder still to get through a waitlist. For survivors of sexual violence, that can lead to a difficult path to getting help, and a difficult task for the nonprofits that provide low-cost support. The latest closure comes from the Victoria Sexual Assault Center, which announced it would be shutting down its long-term counseling program due to a lack of resources. One Reddit user wrote, "I've been on the waitlist for trauma therapy related to sexual abuse. I've been waiting for 4 years. Another user wrote, "It seems that there is no true help available." Nina Kang, the executive director of Ending Violence Association of BC, says they've seen a rise in gender-based violence throughout the pandemic, both in terms of number and severity.
These types of abuses, this type of crime flourishes when there's isolation. And, you know, COVID has played a very key role in all of us being isolated.
I wanted to find out more about what's happening on the ground in Victoria, along with how it plays into the bigger picture across the province. So I first spoke with Sam Lopey. She's the direct client services manager at the Victoria Sexual Assault Center and works firsthand with the counseling team. I also spoke with Johnny Morris. He's the CEO of the Canadian Mental Health Association's BC division. First, here's my conversation with Sam. Sam, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jackie. Happy to be here.
Can you first explain what exactly the long-term counseling program was?
Absolutely. So here at the Victoria Sexual Assault Center, we offer a range of services in our healing program, our justice program, and prevention education. One of the elements of our counseling program for a while was long-term, one-year individual counseling. That was meant to be an opportunity to do deeper work, sit down one-on-one weekly with a counselor and work through sexualized violence experiences and trauma. That was essentially the offer. We have other programs that are individual counseling that are shorter term. We have group programs, as well as a host of other things, all offered completely free of charge. But the long term was structured around that 1 year of individual counseling.
How long did that program run?
Before my time, but I would say that it was over a decade that we were able to offer that. The organization, Victoria Sexual Assault Center, has been around for 40 years. So it was a core part of our programming for quite a while.
How impactful was it on people who ended up using it?
Oh, well, I mean, there is a lack of long-term free or affordable counseling in our community for survivors of sexualized violence, but also for folks suffering from other mental illnesses, mental health, needing support around families or relationships. So there's a need in the community and there's not really a lot of options. So I'd say the impact was we were a place that could offer that. And sometimes survivors would come to talk about their sexualized violence experience, but sometimes they also needed to talk about other things. And that became a bit of a struggle for us to help them with everything they needed when our specialty and our expertise is around sexualized violence specifically.
Do you know of any programs in the city that are similar that, you know, maybe you've been turning people to?
There are a number of other community organizations that offer counseling, that offer groups, but nothing in the 1 year range. There are lots of different specializations where they'll focus on mental health support or housing or family or relationship, domestic violence, but specifically for 1 year long term, not that I know. And if I am mistaken, please call me because I'd love to send folks your way. Free and affordable is the real part that makes that difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it really was a unique offering.
It was. Yeah.
What considerations went into canceling it?
Quite a significant amount. I would say that over the last 3 years, so even before the pandemic, we were having to take some very hard looks at our statistics and our capacity as a nonprofit organization. We always had a wait list for the long-term individual support. Was always about 2 or 3 years, and that was kind of expected. But what happened over the last couple of years was that our crisis counseling program was also now starting to get a wait list. So before, we could have our long-term support and our crisis support, which focuses on assisting survivors with the most immediate emotional, physical, or behavioral reactions to either a recent sexual assault or historic abuse that's now come up to make it difficult for them to go to work, go to school, look after their families, operate comfortably day to day. So what we saw was that not only did we have the wait list growing slowly for the long-term support, but we were starting to see the wait list grow for that crisis support as well. That's where a lot of our youth come through. That's where all of our recent survivors come through, or folks that have had historical traumas that are now dealing with immediate crisis. So we were having folks wait 1, 2, 3, then 4 months before they could see a counselor after either a recent assault or experiencing a crisis. And that became something that Victoria Sexual Assault could not continue with because we saw the need for crisis as so high and our capacity wasn't there to offer both the long-term and the crisis program. So we had to make a really difficult decision. And that was why we decided to end the long-term program.
So to be clear then, the resources that were allocated to this long-term counseling program are now going to be directed at the more immediate crisis situations.
Yes, absolutely. We always had a group program as well. So the focus is firstly on crisis and then on our groups as well. So folks can still do some of that deeper trauma work, some psychoeducation, some learning of skills, knowledge, peer support. So there's still an opportunity for that, but we just can't offer it one-on-one. Now it's in a group capacity. But yeah, a lot of our capacity is going to make sure that folks don't have to wait, well, as short as possible to see a counselor when they first reach out. We know that if you can connect with somebody at that first point of contact, we may be the first time someone's disclosing what's happened. If we can connect them when they're reaching out for support, we're getting them at a point where I think it makes quite a bit of difference in the healing journey.
Mm-hmm. It really sounds like you're having to prioritize what is most needed in the immediate moment instead of thinking about people and their experiences over the long term and how to continue with them as they grow and move on from what happened. Is that difficult to have to do that?
Absolutely. We didn't end the long-term program because we don't think it's needed. Mm-hmm. We didn't end it because we don't think it's valuable as a healing path, or that we didn't wish we still could offer it. It did come down to some elements of capacity, but also there are many paths to healing. Long-term individual counseling is one of them. And for some folks, it works wonderfully. For other folks, not the same. So we even had some people on our long-term list who would have to wait 2, 3, getting close to 4 years. And they would cycle back to us through our crisis program, sometimes multiple times during that wait. And I believe that they were getting support in those moments that they needed it. And while I think that it would be wonderful if we had a program in the community to offer long-term individual deep trauma for the folks that really want to deep dive into that and work through it. But there are lots of different moments when healing can happen. And you know, once a week for a year isn't the only way for that healing to happen. So we really are trying to respond to the needs of the community. And over the last couple of years, they've kind of been showing us through the way they're showing up, asking for our services, that what they need is something that's a little more flexible. Mm-hmm. So even though it was a great program, and I would love for there to potentially be other opportunities, either with us or other organizations, we're really trying to listen to what the community and survivors need and respond in that way.
You, in the release, had said that you have already reached out to all the survivors that were on the wait list. Mm-hmm. What was the general response that you got?
Yeah, I have reached out, and I'll say if there are any survivors that have yet to, you know, things can get lost in a voicemail inbox or in an email inbox. So if you haven't, this is the first time you're hearing this news, please call our access line at 250-383-3232, and you can talk to someone about this. But overall, definitely a variety of reactions. Of course, there will be. I've had an opportunity to speak directly with a number of survivors, and while some of them are, of course, very upset that it's not something we can offer anymore, we do have some avenues to try and find them additional supports. And beyond that, we also still have our crisis program, which is shorter term, but still one-on-one individual counseling, as well as groups and other supports. And some survivors, they really understand. They really understand that we can only do so much with what we have, but also that there are, like I said, lots of different paths to healing. And so a couple of folks have said, yeah, you know what? I've actually feeling in a good place right now, but I know that if in the future I ever need you, it'll be nice to know that I can connect more quickly. So that door is always wide open for folks to come back and see us if they need us 6 months down the line, 6 years down the line, and we'll be able to see them more quickly when they're in that highest need.
How many people does the ending of this program impact?
Well, I was going to say probably more than just the folks on my list, but we're looking at about 250 folks, give or take, so directly for wait lists. I would say that number is larger in the sense that we're now a resource that we, you know, other organizations can't say, oh, yeah, we know of a free long-term program, go here. So it's hard to say what that impact will be, but I do really want to make sure people know that we are still here and that they can contact us now or in the future if needed.
There have actually been a lot of high-profile sexual assault or sexualized violence or harassment cases in recent years in Victoria. Do you think that this is because there's a burgeoning culture of coming forward in the city, or is there some other serious issues that are specific to this city?
Well, I'm not an expert on this outside of my work here at the Sexual Assault Center. So when it comes to the crime aspect of it, I can't speak to that too directly. But what I will say is that I've seen a pretty significant change in folks coming forward. There is a movement of reducing the stigma around being a survivor of sexualized violence. Not to say it's gone, but I hope that in some small way, Victoria Sexual Assault can contribute to folks feeling like they have a soft place to land when reaching out, a place that can, with no kind of judgment or stigma, hear what's happened to them and be able to respond with supports and services. So I think that there is a shifting in the culture happening here that is making it a bit more comfortable. Well, I don't know if comfortable is the right word. I think there's a shift in the culture happening here that's allowing folks to feel a bit more safe coming forward. Yeah.
So the services that you're offering, it's not that there's suddenly more people that need it. It's that there are suddenly more people that are coming forward to claim what they need.
I think it's a bit of both. I think that to some degree, folks are coming forward more, which I am very happy to see. But I also think that, from our numbers, we have just seen more people coming through our doors. For example, last year in 2021, we saw about 1,000 survivors come through our doors. We saw a little bit of a dip in the pandemic because the lockdowns, we saw a few less of the need for our immediate sexual assault response team. But before the pandemic in 2019, we're seeing increased numbers from then. So there is a trend for folks accessing our services more. We're seeing some of the highest increases in the under 24 and under 18 age demographics for us as well. So where some younger folks didn't always come forward for our services, we're seeing more and more of that over the last couple of years, both during the pandemic and before.
This kind of plays into the conversation around the provincial healthcare system funding mental health care. And is that something that the Victoria Sexual Assault Center discusses or ever in contact with any of our MLAs?
Absolutely. We over the last 3 years, I would say, we were looking very seriously at the long-term program and how it could continue. And the first go was funding. The first opportunity was, how can we bring in more money to provide our crisis program, our group program, and our long-term program moving forward? But one of the challenges with funding, and I want to identify that we do have some very generous funders from the community and also thousands of private donors that are very generous to our organization every year. And I want to thank all of them, because without that, we wouldn't be able to provide any of our services completely free of charge. So the call here is not that we could bring long-term back if we got more money, because the amount it would take to do that is really above and beyond what would be appropriate for us to gather from even a collection of funders. And it's about the longevity of it as well. So even if, you know, 2 or 3 years of funding is freed up, there's something about making a commitment that we know can last for decades moving forward. If we're going to offer something like that long-term support, we would hate to offer it and then take it away, offer it and then take it away. So we're noticing that the changing needs of the community, we're trying to adapt to use what funding and resources we have in the best way possible to serve the most amount of people in ways that are really reflecting what they're asking for, which I think are changing over time, just like lots of things do, right? But we've seen quite the increase in, you know, the complexity of the needs that survivors are coming to our organization with. So, you know, housing insecurity, loss of employment, suffering from more suicidal thoughts, depression, social isolation. And even though the pandemic hopefully is wrapping up in the next little while, there is, I think, a complexity to what survivors need that's going to continue. So I would love an opportunity, if there's more money to be had, I think there's a real opportunity to focus on integration in support. We do, I think, the sexualized violence support. We've got some really, really talented counselors and support workers on our team. But we know of lots of other community organizations too that we work with very closely, partnerships, relationships, so we can provide as much wraparound service for survivors as possible. So,
Sam, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate it a lot.
Jackie, thank you so much for having me here. Like I mentioned before, we're really encouraged to let survivors know that we, even though we can't offer the long-term program anymore, we are still here, just in a different way.
Victoria is not the only area in BC that's having this problem. And the issue doesn't just end at survivors of sexualized violence. To get a look at the bigger picture around the province's approach to mental health care, I spoke with CMHA BC's Johnny Morris. Before that, we'll hear a quick word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Ecologist. Ecologist will soon be located at 552 Johnson Street. The Victoria Born and Raised clothing brand is opening a revamped flagship store and is excited to welcome you into their new space. The store is currently wrapped in bright green if you want to walk by and have a look in advance. That address again is 552 Johnson Street and their ecologist.com. That's ecologyst.com. And now, our conversation with the Canadian Mental Health Association, BC, CEO, Johnny Morris. Johnny, welcome back to the podcast.
Jackie, thanks so much for having me back on the podcast.
Okay, so this program is a long-term counseling program for survivors of sexualized violence or sexual harassment. So losing it, what kind of hole does that leave?
I would say it leaves a very significant hole in the fabric of care that survivors of sexualized violence have to access. And I think particularly the loss of a service that's designed to provide long-term counseling to survivors is a significant loss to be reckoned with for the community writ large, and of course for the agency itself, who I know as a very credible agency, you know, values its ability to provide responsive quality care to the people it serves. So it does absolutely represent a loss in the availability of low cost or free, freely available, high quality counseling support.
This was free, and that made it very accessible for a lot of people. That also made a very long wait list. And it's unfortunate that because of the demand, they aren't able to keep programs, this one specifically, up and running. Is this something that you think the government should be stepping in and funding under healthcare?
Yeah, we've chatted before in and around the importance of creating as much access as possible to mental health and substance use care. We really do need to find ourselves in a world where cost is not a barrier to getting care, whether it's because you're needing trauma care, whether it's because you're living with depression. Recently, you know, and over the past couple of years, you know, we've been very encouraged by the province stepping in to provide funding for community-based counseling agencies. And there are currently, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, 49 community agencies that have had their funding extended to provide low-cost or free community counseling. And that's been such a critical step forward. It's one of the most sustained investments that we've seen in community counseling, kind of removing those barriers. Now, of course, it's not every agency in the province. It's 49 agencies who went through a process to receive grants to receive that funding. But we would say we're heartened by it being a step in the right direction of starting to, not all of the way, of course, but starting to better equalize, you know, access to counseling care specifically. We absolutely, I think, you know, would be calling upon, you know, all levels of government to examine how we bring counseling care much more in line with our access to publicly funded physical health care. And there's been a big push recently by the BC Psychological Association, by a number of parties around, you know, enhancing access to counseling, you know, going forward.
Yeah, losing a program that's free actually made me curious about the gap in mental health access or mental health care access, because a lot of people can't afford the out-of-pocket costs or they aren't with an employer that offers that kind of benefit. So, I mean, there is some development needed in that area, but there is an outline, a pathway to hope, and that's what this $4.2 million funding that you just referenced is a part of. Can you give an overview of what that actually is?
Yeah, the Pathway to Hope, and again, this is from the perspective of the Canadian Mental Health Association, so, you know, outside of government, but a Pathway to Hope is the roadmap for mental health and substance use care in this province. And it includes a number of actions and commitments that are focused in some ways on early intervention, providing care to young people. Foundries are a really good example. Some of our programs, Bounce Back, which is free depression and anxiety coaching, Confident Parents, I mean, kids, all kind of part of a building block in that plan around improving access, right? So a lot of, if not all of the services we offer at CMHA are free at the point of access. And this community counseling investment that was recently announced is one example. Because I think we at CMHA absolutely recognize what you're saying there, Jackie. You know, there, if you don't have a benefits plan with an employer, if you don't have access to the funds to pay for a psychologist or a counselor, if the barriers to access low cost or free quality counseling are huge for people. And we need to change that. And I think this recent investment is a step in the right direction to changing that. It doesn't detract from the fact that the Sexual Assault Center has lost its ability to offer a long-term counseling program, and that is a loss that will be felt by many. And I think we have to think large about, well, what's the root of this problem, right? And in many ways, it's how dedicated, core, sustained funding flows from the federal government, you know, under the banner of mental health and substance use care. And we've seen absolutely improvements. There's a dedicated transfer. There's commitments for a continued dedicated transfer from the feds to support that. But if you look closely at the Canada Health Act, it only contemplates a particular kind of care, and that's hospital-based psychiatric care. So community-based mental health care, you know, doesn't show up as much in our publicly funded way, like many are calling for.
It's commonly said that we're in a mental health crisis, and there's also a lot of discussion around integrating mental health care with physical health care in terms of how it's funded and coverage. And so you're saying that starts with the way the federal government approaches this.
Yeah. So in some places, there's a huge call for parity, which is jargon for putting mental health care and substance use care on the same footing as physical health care. And that can be, you know, at the point when it comes to funding. So how things are funded, you know, that there's equity in budgets. And also, you know, if you're sitting in front of your doctor or you're sitting in front of another health care professional, you know, there's an expectation that your mental health and physical health care are treated in the same way at the same level. And so, I would say, you know, really looking at how federally mental health care is funded through the transfers to the provinces and territories is an important thing to reflect upon. And it absolutely goes without saying that we've seen progress there. We've absolutely seen progress there. But is it kind of future-proofed into how funding flows in this country? You know, I think there are a number of groups that would say, no, we need to take a look at the Canada Health Act and make sure that mental health care and substance use care spending is absolutely protected in the same ways as other kinds of publicly funded and free physical health care. Because we'll always be in this conversation. We've heard calls, Jackie, for dental care. We've seen political parties call for dental care to be funded in a better publicly funded way. We've had many senior politicians on record calling for that. And the same argument could absolutely be leveraged at funding for mental health and substance use care.
It seems like there's a lot of progress that is being made, whether, you know, slow or not, it's still being made. But right now, we did just see a program in the immediate close down. What does this tell you?
That we are seeing progress, and I think many would argue it's incremental progress, you know, in its nature. And I think we would say too, and others would say, you know, that there is an opportunity for bold, transformative change at many levels when it comes to access to mental health and substance use care. And not just the care. I was reading, you know, other comments recently about really, you know, looking at the conditions that create distress, poverty, violence, discrimination. And that links back to the start of the story, an agency, you know, responding to people who've experienced sexualized violence is so critical for people to experience support in the aftermath of that kind of traumatic experience. So what does it suggest? Well, it suggests that, change is precarious and precious. It also suggests that demand for service currently outstrips supply. And what we were all recognizing amidst compounding crises, climate change related crises, pandemic, a drug poisoning crisis, is that bold transformative action is going to be the nature of how we move forward and ensure that our mental health and well-being is not left behind, whilst remembering that some groups of folks, some populations are absolutely impacted, you know, more than others when it comes to mental health and these crises that are happening right now.
Johnny, thank you so much for joining us again.
Absolutely. And I would say for your listeners, this is a story of loss of an important community service. And I think it sounds like the agency is structuring its care to be as responsive as possible. My sense would be, that they as an agency are hoping people will still reach out to them if they need care, if they've experienced sexualized violence of any kind. And also for your listeners, the BC Crisis Line Network is available too, 310-6789. That is 24/7 confidential support, 310-6789. And of course, for the Sexual Assault Center, they have a website and a crisis line number that people can call as well. I think it's really important for people to know as they listen to your podcast that help is available despite the loss of this particular program in the community.
Yeah, thank you. Today's episode description also contains contact information for the Victoria Sexual Assault Center. If you want to help support Capital Daily's local journalism and connect your business with our engaged and curious Greater Victoria audience of over 50,000, you can email our partnerships team at advertising@capitaldaily.ca. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a rating and a review and also subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes going forward. We post new shows every Monday to Friday. My name is Jackie Lamport. This is the Capital Daily Podcast. We'll talk to you tomorrow.